my understanding you have an author's amendment. Is that correct? The D3? A3, I'm sorry?
Yeah, I just want to make sure we're on. Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chairman. What this is Peace in the Valley Amendment. It takes out Subdivision 4 of the bill. It's agreed to by Fresh Energy in the municipal and co-op areas.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. Representative Hoppe, you'll move the author's amendment, A3. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Garofalo, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is actually a really cool bill, unlike every other bill I carry. But the what this does is right now, people who have electric vehicles, if they come home and they plug their vehicle in at 5 or 6 o'clock at night, that's when the peak rates are. And it costs all of us, whether we have an electric car or not, more money. What this does is it allows has investor-owned utilities set up a new rate, new tariff, where they offer a rate overnight at a substantial savings. So it does save EV owners money. More importantly, it saves all of us who don't own electrical vehicles money because we're not buying vehicles at peak rates. So it's a good bill, and I'd ask for member support. Now, there's a fiscal note on this because the Department of Commerce says it's going to cost them $5,000.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. Are there anyone that desires to be heard with respect to the bill? Any questions or concerns from members? Seeing none, Representative Hoppe. Representative Dean, I'm sorry, I just didn't see you there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, quick question. So I'm assuming that the plug-in stations then are monitored so that the electric company knows when they're plugging in the daytime versus the evening time or nighttime?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, what it does is they actually set up a second meter in the home. And there's, like, in my area, Dakota Electric, it actually is only allowed to work between 11 p.m. and, or, like, off-peak hours. So the short answer is yes, there's a separate meter that tracks them.
Anything further?
Yes.
Unless there's any other questions, Representative Hoppe will renew his motion that House File 2884 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well done.
And thank you, Representative Garofalo. You're welcome back anytime you want to come. Next up is House File 2537, Representative Markwart's bill. The chair will move House File 2537 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Markwart, it is my understanding that there is a DE3 author's amendment. If you will affirm that that is, in fact, an author's amendment.
Yes.
The chair will move the DE3 as an author's amendment. That's being passed out. Normally, we would just take that and put it in the shape that the author would like to proceed, but since it is hot off the press and reflective of a compromise, is my understanding, we're going to wait until you've had a chance to present briefly what's going on, and then we'll take that DE3 and make it part of the bill. So, Representative Markwart, to your bill.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much. And Mr. Chair, if I could, because I don't know if all of your members have talked much about the propane situation, but this last winter, as you know, we had a propane crisis. And what it led to was propane shortages that led to increased propane prices. And the primary reasons for that is that the U.S. Is exporting where it used to be about 5%, it's about 20% of the propane. Late planting, late harvest, wetter crops, and even though we expected that, it wound up farmers using about four times the normal amount of propane that they had in the past. And then you had a winter that was the worst in 30 years. So where prices in October were maybe $1.50 to $1.60 a gallon for propane, spiked all the way up to $6.67, and an average over the winter was probably around $4. And so I have to say that the propane industry stepped up to the plate. They provided, at least this was up to a couple weeks ago, they had delivered about double the amount of product as they had the year before, and they had about 370,000 additional deliveries this year. In fact, I know of a lot of situations where they went out of their way to make sure that they got propane to customers. So they did an excellent job. On the other side of the coin, though, the Commerce Department opened up a hotline during this time, and they had about 4,000 calls. And many of those calls dealt with customers who either were out of propane, they had complaints about increased prices, increased fees, late deliveries, and those type of things. And the Department of Commerce, and with leadership of the governor and the propane industry, they're able to bring everyone together to make sure that people got the propane. But it took a lot of work and a lot of cooperation to do that. So this probably may not get a lot better, Mr. Chair, the Cochin pipeline that's bringing in propane into this area. Is they're going to redirect that. That's about 40% of the supply. So this discussion, even though we had kind of this trifecta, this perfect storm, if you will, that occurred, that created this situation, this probably isn't going away. And so the basis of what I'm trying to do here with the DE3 amendment, which is, I think, a pretty big change from what we had before, is to make sure that folks in this state can assure that they're safe and warm in their homes and not having to really worry about that. And so that's the main thing of this bill. And one thing, members, I get the question is, why would we do some regulations on propane? Right now they're unregulated. And we know that investor-owned utilities and municipals and cooperatives, they have a defined territory, and the customer really doesn't have a choice. So why are we putting propane under the same type of thing? And I would suggest to this committee that propane users, while they do have a choice to switch customers, have a very limited choice. And I say that because most customers for propane lease their tanks. Let's say it's a 500-gallon tank. And they can lease those tanks for $50 a year. That might be a rough cost. Where to purchase a propane tank might be $900 to $1,500. So if you lease the tank, you have to get your product from that propane company. And when you get into the middle of the winter, and it's 20, 30 below, and you're a senior citizen, and you're running out of propane, do you really have a choice? Or an unlimited choice to get propane? And I would just seriously have committee members think about that. And so it's important we bring all the stakeholders together because this is not something that's going to go away. So, again, it's very simple. Let's make sure people get heat when they need heat, and we can do that in a way that can create a lot less worry. In the first committee we had, Mr. Chair, we heard about a lot of things that the propane industry did to get product to their customers. Why don't we just formalize? Everyone wants to get heat and product to these customers, but let's formalize the process on things that they've already done. So here's where we're at, Mr. Chair. This DE3 amendment eliminates three areas that the propane industry was very opposed to. The cold weather rule is gone. The delinquent payments, where you would have to carry people maybe for a couple months on delinquent payments, that's gone out of this DE3 amendment. Registration requirements that the Commerce Department would require, that's gone. Those are the three biggest areas that I've met with the propane folks and trying to bring things together. That's what I heard. Those are all gone out of the DE3 amendment. So, Mr. Chair, I was talking earlier to the propane folks just a few minutes ago. I don't think we have peace in the valley. I'm disappointed in that, quite frankly, because we're at a point where we've taken away three of the hugest things, 1, 2, 3 that I thought. But I know, there's going to be others to talk. So I have some testifiers. I can go over what this still does if you want. Mr. Chair, it's whatever you would desire at this point.
And Representative Markwart, at this point, I think members have had the DE3 in their hands for a long enough time to peruse it. It is an author's amendment, so the chair will move the DE3 amendment as an author's amendment. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, seeing none, that motion prevails. So the bill is actually in the shape in which you'd like to proceed with it. Is there anybody, any key people that you want to make? Obviously, it's the final day of our committee's time. Is there anyone that you want to critically hear from in support of the bill? Otherwise, we'll take some tests. And you've obviously got a friend here with you as well.
Yeah, so. We've got Ms. Winter here, but also Commissioner Rothman is here, who would like to testify to this. And then I also know there's folks from the propane industry that would like to speak.
All right. So. Commissioner, would you like to be heard? Otherwise, we've got the representative from the department, I believe, and it's nice that we've got Commissioner Rothman here with us as well. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Marquardt did a really great job of sort of summarizing the overview of the propane crisis. The governor declared a peacetime emergency, as many know. Worked very hard to make sure that we had trucking restrictions eliminated so that we could have trucks go down. Personally got on the phone with pipeline suppliers to make sure that those folks were getting supply here, wrote letters to the White House, worked with our delegation. And out of that, importantly, got a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission order prioritizing shipment of propane to the Midwest, which brought supply to Minnesota, helped alleviate a lot of the shortage situation. Representative Marquardt also indicated that prices spiked. Governor asked that I keep track of the prices and all of that. I'm happy to be a resource on the background information. I know a lot of folks have already heard a lot about what happened, why it happened. I'm happy to go through that as well. Our thoughts on how to prevent it, and then perhaps just focusing on this specific legislation. I want to thank Representative Marquardt and all the folks that have worked on the bill for the last 2-3 weeks. There are some very important provisions in them. As we saw during the propane crisis, there were 4,000 people who called in desperate situation with tanks almost out, with problems that they had in delivery. And some of these were people who were looking for low-income heating assistance, which we helped. We got additional funding from the legislature to help with that. But also, we got a lot of calls from people about the concerns on the consumer protection side. And we did everything we could to make sure that we were helping them. I also do want to acknowledge that we worked in a triage capacity through the crisis with the propane industry. That it was very a good working relationship. At the same time, we have worked on several provisions on this bill and had them amended and added on. I just want to highlight that these have great consumer protection provisions in them. Of course, there are some that are not at this stage that. That are not in the bill, but at the same time, just to highlight a few of them from the department's perspective that I think are very important. We do have some of the terms of sale provisions. Some of these consumer protections are important. And then we also have some of the additions in sections 9, 10, and 11 from the department that we think will be very helpful on the to be able to, one, know when the supply of propane. We're alerted when it gets really bad, a bad situation, that we have that warning signal in place, that we have additional strength in our discrimination provisions, basically saying that consumers should be treated equally with their contract provisions and all of that. And so I just want to just thank again the author and working diligently on this, and I'd say, hopefully we can get something passed. And I would just, in closing, want to echo this, and I've said it before in committee, is that we did go through a very serious situation this past January and February. It's touch and go. We're not out of winter yet. It's still April. We still have a lot of people to help, and who knows what will happen with the weather. We also know that the Kinder Morgan Cochin pipeline is going to close, or at least reverse flow, sorry, not close, but reverse flow on propane, which is going to cause a serious intermediate and long-term problem for the state of Minnesota. And so that we're anticipating that these issues may not be fully resolved and that we should be prepared in any way that we can for these things to happen next, and do what we can to mitigate and prevent it from happening next winter. So. I've said it before, I think it's all hands on deck. However we can solve some of these issues, work together, find solutions on the supply side, work with folks in the industry on propane marketing, supply, distribution, retail, make sure that, you know, we get the propane to the local communities throughout Minnesota and do whatever we can on that as well. So I just want to thank you again and stand for questions if there are any for me.
Thank you, Commissioner. Why don't, actually, if it's all right, I'd like to hold for questions until we hear a little bit. Is there folks that have concerns about the bill or opposed to the bill? And quite frankly, we don't have a chance to hear from literally everybody today, but I would like to have a balanced discussion.
Yeah.
Mr. Holton, welcome back to the Commerce Committee. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Court Holton. I represent the Minnesota propane industry, and we've been working on this at a fevered pace for quite some time. I just got this in my hands a little while ago. Much of it we talked about earlier today. I do want to start out with one comment, and that is, in order for this bill to get heard in the Senate, the senators directed us to come to an agreement and resolve our issues, which we ultimately did on paper. That was turned into an amendment. Therefore, the bill was heard in the Senate and made deadline. And I'm somewhat disappointed that the department did not just simply stick with that. I know that's not your problem. This is much closer to what we proposed than how the bill started out. There's still a couple of problems with it, and which will be discussed by our propane distributor sitting next to me, and that is on page 3, lines 24 and 25, which I think that could be a communications issue. It's I think what we mean to say there is you can't charge such a fee to a keep fill customer, but I'm not the expert. And I think there was one other, you know, the reporting requirement was, that's on section 8, that's on page 4.4 to 4.14. It was chiseled down to what you see in front of you by discussions that we had today. We still have the question for the committee is, you know, what is the value of this information? What's, you know, what's really going to be done with it? Other sections of the bill that we thought were aimed at the supply and demand problem are not in this bill. We thought those were the ones that were in this bill that actually addressed the issues of this past winter, which were significant and which could be repeated. I don't myself quite know how to react to all this because it's moving too fast. I think it probably needs work. I will defer to my client who knows more about this by far than I do.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, committee, my name is Brad Box, and I represent Northern Star Cooperative Services. Our main office is in Deer River, Minnesota. We serve about 8,500 propane customers in northern and north central Minnesota. Couple things that I see in this amended version of the bill that are troublesome for me. I start on page 2 and look at lines 21 through 24, and it says a propane distributor that offers customer service and service options, and then it lists some of those, must do the same to all new and existing customers. To be quite honest, I can't offer keep fill service to every customer. It just does not work. Keep fill is a system in which we use heating degree days to judge when we go to the house next. If a house uses 300 gallons in 3,000 heating degree days, we know that we make the delivery, we fill the tank, and 3,000 heating degree days later, we need to go there again. If someone uses wood, or if they heat part-time with electricity, or they use some alternative, or they leave for part of the time, they are a person that does not qualify for a keep full program or a scheduled delivery program. So that just doesn't work for us. And when I look at some of the other things that are in there, budget payments, we do offer budget payments to everyone. I see that they did take contracting out or credit out, but when it says services or service options, I'm a little concerned of what that could mean. So I have some, because obviously I can't offer credit to everybody. If they don't meet our credit qualifications, we can't offer credit to them. Court mentioned page 3, lines 24 and 25. A propane distributor may not charge a customer fee for emergency delivery for which payment is made from LIHEAP funds. Unfortunately, those are the customers that require the most after hours and emergency deliveries, and for no other reason that a lot of those customers don't go to their tank to check their percentage. Not because they can't in most cases, just because they don't, because they've always been able to rely on LIHEAP to cover those trip charges, and that's always been a problem for us as distributors, is why should LIHEAP funds be used to pay those charges when someone has some accountability and has the ability to look at the gauge on their tank to see that they're low before they're out. So that one is problematic for me. We did a profit pilot program a few years ago that studied our efficiency of our trucks and studied the costs of our trucks, and it costs us, 5 years ago, it costs us $4.80 a mile to operate a propane truck. $4.80 per mile driven. So if I have a customer that calls out of gas and we have to go there that night and they're 30 or 40 miles away, I've got $150 before we deliver a gallon of gas into the cost of that. So if I can't recoup any of those costs, it's problematic for us as a customer. And what that does is that raises the price of delivery to every customer. I'll close just by, you know, I think a lot of this bill, the original bill, and the Department of Commerce's reason for getting this bill comes down to, you know, when we had the crisis, there was a toll-free hotline number put out there. And on that toll-free hotline number, apparently they got about 4,000 calls. And by the department's admission, about half of those calls were for assistance and about half were complaints. If we take those numbers and we say 2,000 were for complaints, that's less than 1% of the propane customers in Minnesota called and complained. I can almost guarantee you that if you put a toll-free number out for people to call when the price of gasoline goes up a dollar, you're going to have at least 1% of the people call on that number too and complain. So I think it's really an overreaction on the part of the Department of Commerce, and I would ask the committee to vehemently to oppose this bill until it's amended.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Box. Colton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One last comment. For those of you who were involved, you would have been amazed to see the work and sacrifice that went on this winter by government, by the propane industry, by people outside of the state, the governor of Texas, others, to really bend over backwards to get us all through this crisis. So the industry was quite amazed when they saw this bill as originally introduced. Representative Marquardt has put in a ton of work and has had endless meetings with people. I'm not sure he knew what he was getting into. And lastly, this is a continuation of a debate that's been going on here, well, at least for half of my career, which is getting to be quite long now. The attempts by the advocates who have just cause to put together a regulated utility-type response to propane issues. And a regulated utility, as you know, is sort of an involuntary partnership between government and private enterprise, and government gets something out of it, and the private enterprise gets something out of it. All of these proposals that have dealt with us, it's been government gets something out of it and we get nothing out of it, and that's not a utility, and we're not a utility, and I wish people would stop thinking in that paradigm. Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Holton. And with that, members, we will lay over House File 2537. I appreciate the effort that's been made with the DE. We'll look forward to the folks, proponents and opponents, having an opportunity to continue to visit with respect to that. And thank you, Representative Marquardt. We
Mr.
appreciate
Chair,
your
members,
effort.
Thank you so much.
Thank
appreciate
you. Next up, we're going to turn to a couple of the bills that that I've got. Representative Fritz is going to chair that portion. I did note, though, I think Representative Hoppe, we moved Representative Garofalo's bill to the General Register. It actually is going to Ways and Means for the fiscal piece of it. So Representative Hoppe will move to reconsider House File 2884. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, seeing none. Representative Hoppe then will renew his motion that House File 2884 be re-referred to Ways and Means as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, do we want to tell Garofalo?
No, let's not. He'll find out soon enough. He'll just wonder what happened to his bill.
Which one?
Okay.
Welcome, Representative Atkins. Would you like to start with House File 2853?
Actually, why don't we go with 2854?
All right.
This is the I'll move 2854 be referred to the General Register.
And I see you have an amendment.
Madam Chair, I do, and that is an author's amendment. It's the 814-1019. And Madam Chair, I know it's an author's amendment. We normally vote on it immediately. In this case, I just wanted to note for members, there isn't much in this, but it's Representative Johnson's bill that's about to be heard after this, and it's his unsessioned bill out of the Telecom, Labor and Regulated and Telecom Committee. So we're a little bit out of order, but Representative Johnson wasn't able to join us just yet. I hope members are okay with that. I'm assuming they are. But that's the brief explanation behind it. My understanding is that there's nothing that's terribly controversial within Representative Johnson's bill. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd move the author's amendment.
All right. Representative Atkins moves A14-1019. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted to the bill, Representative Atkins.
And thank you, Madam Chair. You've got the summary, I'm sure, but I don't think there's a bill in the House that repeals more. It's 1,726 lines of statute, somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 pages, 918 pages of rules, 53 pages overall, that the department and all of the various stakeholders that have weighed in have said are either redundant, obsolete. It's all sorts of things like regulation of sale of insurance policies from vending machines at the airport to fruit size or the size of fruit containers that currently would make the folks at Cub or Costco or other places, if they sold it in the wrong size container, turn those poor people into criminals. All of the provisions in here have been out and about for a long time. These are only the provisions on which folks were in agreement that were in fact obsolete or worthy of repeal. It does clean up our statutes considerably, and I think it makes a lot easier for consumers and business folks and out-of-state folks looking to do business here in Minnesota to work their way through our statutes, understand what they mean, and help both with consumer protection and with job creation. With that, Madam Chair, I'd stand for any questions that members may have.
And any questions, members? Seeing none. Anyone else in the audience care to testify on this in or against? I don't see anyone. So, Representative Atkins, we will refer your bill as we'll move to refer your bill, House File 2854, as amended to be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The bill is on its way. Representative Atkins,
you,
House File 2853.
And Madam Chair, House File 2853 is also a department bill. It's the department's housekeeping bill. As so often happens, Madam Chair, there.
Would you like to move your bill?
I would. I'm about to get there. It is as so often happens, there's a number of amendments to that. I just wanted to kind of alert people to the fact that Mr. Pender has worked awfully hard the last few days, getting some last-minute non-controversial amendments drafted to it. With that, I would move House File 2853 be referred to the General Register.
And then we do have the amendments. Do you want to go right to those?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would. Before we get to the A1, actually the order in which I'd like to do them is Representative Dean has worked very, very hard on the A6 amendment. This is with respect to, and members all know this one very well. If it's all right with Representative Dean, I just soon offer it as an author's amendment. It's with regard to providing that an insured may bring a DEC declaratory judgment action to determine whether or not there's coverage with respect to certain STOLE policies. My understanding now is that all of the folks have come to a point where they're either equally satisfied or dissatisfied or however you want to describe it. But I think if you want, you can take my word for it or Representative Dean's word for it. All parties now are in a place where they can agree to this amendment. I think they've all talked with the key people. Representative Hoppe, I see, is nodding. We'd be happy to welcome them down to attest to that if you'd like. Otherwise,
we're good.
All right. I didn't want to do an author's amendment without some explanation, especially on a topic that has been somewhat dicey over the course of time. But, Madam Chair, in light of Representative Hoppe's comment, I'll move the A6 as an author's amendment to put it in the shape that the author would like to move
forward
with it.
To the A6 amendment, members, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment has been adopted. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Dean. Next up, and I believe these have now been passed out, Mr. Kwapik, is an A11 amendment. It's been passed out, of course, to everyone except for me. And so, if I could, thank you, Representative Kaczynski. This was brought to me, I believe it's the land title amendment, Mr. Pender. It is non-controversial. It's the A11, and I move the A11 amendment.
Any discussion on the A11 amendment, members? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Okay, the amendment has been adopted. Representative Atkins.
And Madam Chair, next author's amendment is the A12 regarding qualified financial contracts. This was brought to me by certain folks in the financial services industry. It's been run by the Department of Commerce. They've signed off on it as well. It actually is intended to save Minnesota financial services insurers many millions of dollars on an annual basis, as well as making their transactions more secure. With that, I move the A12 as an author's amendment.
The A12 amendment, members, any discussion, any questions? Seeing none, the A12 amendment, in favor of the A12 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment has been adopted. Representative Atkins.
And thank you, Madam Chair. The final two amendments, I'd like to hold just briefly, because I've got Commissioner Rothman here to describe the efforts in the bill, and then the A1 and A2. The A2 is Representative Falk's amendment. The A1 is my amendment, on which I'd like to have a little bit further discussion after Commissioner Rothman has an opportunity to walk through what we're doing with respect to the bill.
Very good. Welcome, Commissioner Rothman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to Representative Atkins for carrying the bill. The bill is pretty straightforward this year in terms of what we're doing. And I'll just give you an overview. Changes the appraiser licensing for federal conformity issues. We had some provisions last year. Petrofund section, technical corrections in our administrative services area, streamlines our enforcement powers, and then adopts two important model acts, which have been discussed, and it's my understanding currently don't have any controversial items in them. Let me go article by article just very quickly. On the Article 1 is licensing, and it deals with appraiser licensing, federal conformity. The provisions are required to be in place by 2015 and are being adopted by all states. These provisions will bring Minnesota into conformity with our, basically the appraiser requirements that are needed throughout the states, and keeps us in conformity so that we can stay accredited in Minnesota as well. On Article 2, these are Petrofund provisions. They are technical changes
The Minnesota Petro Fund Board asked us to bring these forward. One deals with mobile tank definition, and the second is to require that any request for reimbursements from the Petro Fund be submitted for payment within 7 years of the work being performed. There's also a grace period for 1 year so that no one will be caught unawares by this new limitations. It'll help us streamline the administration of the Petro Fund. Article 3 contains administrative services provisions, primarily dealing with our weights and measures division and some of the definitions. They are very technical. For example, the first one is about ASTM standards and whether there was a number one in one of the definitions. In the enforcement area, it makes several changes to streamline and clarify the department's enforcement authority under Chapter 45. Provides us with a more efficient regulatory process when the department takes an action against a licensee who defaults. We spend an awful lot of time and energy and money doing these proceedings, and then lo and behold, there's just a default on the other end. And it allows us to respond to that. We've worked with MFSE, Insurance Federation, the Council of Health Plans on some compromise language that clarifies the department's intent, which is to make orders effective immediately in the event that a licensee defaults and does not respond to the request for a hearing, but at the same time preserving the process in current law for companies that do request a hearing so that there would be due process for those that have objections to the default. Section 2 assists commerce employees in negotiating settlements. Section 4 contains language with respect to the time frame for an insurance producer to notify the department when criminal prosecution begins. It clarifies something. It gives us more of a heads up as to when things are proceeding against them. Sections 3, 5, and through 23 are relating to terminology cleanup, and there was the amendment that was offered to do additional cleanup. And then in Article 4, really, I guess this big substantive area is where we have, Article 5 and Article 6. One is the Model Holding Company Act. We have an existing statute. It's been in place for quite a long time. But the National Association of Insurance Commissioners has proposed modification language to it. In essence, some of these modifications come out of the Great Recession and crisis with respect to how insurance commissioners throughout the 50 states in a global economy would respond to an insolvency and how we can deal with that. And then what we need to do to have tighter regulations around holding companies that are in place to retain these, that retain the insurance companies within them. So we think this is it's an important provision, and we will need this in place no later than January 1, 2016 in any event, so that we can keep our accreditation as a department with the NAIC. As well, the same is true for Article 6. This is called the Risk Assessment and Own Risk Insolvency Model Act. What this does is, in simple layman's terms, is it provides the regulators throughout the 50 states with the ability to look forward, look out the front window, if you will, when you were driving in regulation to see and to see what the companies see in terms of risks ahead. They're already, the major companies are looking at risks in terms of operational risks, with competition risks and all that, rather than simply looking behind in the rearview mirror so that we will be able to see what's coming in the horizon towards our insurance companies. So what it requires is risk assessment to be built into the companies, their modeling, how they understand and comply with the regulations, and then to allow us to see in advance. And that's really what the purpose of the ORSA regulation is about. With that, I would just simply, stand for questions if anyone has any, if there are or not.
Yes, we do have some questions. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And to the Commissioner, on Article 4, page 10, we've got couple questions there. Do the changes on page 10, which establish the process for penalty orders, and require the department to explain the reasons for the order, apply to orders to appear, and orders to produce documents issued by the department.
Mr. Rothman.
Commissioner. Madam Chair, Representative Atkins, can you
on page...
I was scrambling to get the...
I'm sorry. Article 4, page 10.
Does that apply to...
Commissioner.
Well, do those changes that establish the penalty orders, does the department have to explain the reasons for the order? Does it apply to orders to appear or orders to for the documents issued by the department?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Evans, if I understand your question correctly, but the answer is yes. We would still have to put the notice out there what's happening, and they would understand.
I think you know where I'm going with this.
You do have to, we would have to apprise them of what the situation is. What it's really meant to do is, you know, if an individual or an entity is anticipating that they're just going to default on us, the default would, we wouldn't have to expend all the resources to deal with that situation.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess, why isn't there a similar, more formalized process for orders to appear and orders to produce documents that ensure a licensee receives fair notice and is aware of the reason for the demand? And I want to say publicly, I want to thank you publicly, I think you know the situation I'm talking about, where Minsure was bullying one of my licensed agents, and the agent got the order, and it doesn't say anything about what he's being charged with. In my life, in Greg's world, there's two letters I cringe when I get. One is from the IRS, and one is from the Department of Commerce, because you hold our livelihoods in your hands. And what can we do so that when we get that letter from the Department of Commerce that terrifies us, to find out what it's all about? Because my constituent, and thank you very much for helping me like you did, Commissioner, and my constituent, because we were able to get it all worked out and it all worked. But the licensee gets this letter and has no clue what they're being charged with, no clue what's going on, and the Minsure employee was bullying my constituent, and it all worked out in the end, but he's sitting out there for weeks and over a weekend. You always get these on Friday night after you open the mail. That's when you get them. So you're stewing Saturday and Sunday. And he couldn't find out what he was even charged with. He's being bullied by Minsure on an issue. And it was terrifying.
Commissioner.
So what can we do anything so that when you send one of these horrifying letters out that you have to send out at times, I understand that, can you have it such that they will understand what they're being charged with?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, just so I'm clear, I want to be clear, this provision procedurally comes after the letter situation you're talking about. So this is a, you know, during the process of, let's say the department gets a complaint, not your situation, but anyone, and there's an issue, our investigators determine there's a need to investigate that matter and to talk to an individual. That process comes before the orders that we're talking about to, you know, that we would file once the investigation has been complete, you know, and then we bring a formal action. So there's the investigative step, and then there's the formal action step. And this is what's changed here on page 10.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Madam Chair, is there any way that when we get to the situation that you were so helpful in, that the person, is there any way, and maybe this is a, we could go offline or something on this, but is there any way that we can get it so that when this letter comes out that the licensee knows what's going on? Because the way it's set up now, they really don't.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative Davids, we can talk offline about that. Sometimes there's various reasons. On these ones, I would want to say for the record, though, that there's been this historical process and procedure. It comes with a Tennyson warning. It's required. It's standard language, and it's to, you know, basically come and appear before the commissioner or my staff. So I'm happy to talk with you more about how we might be. And again, in this particular situation and any others, you know, some situations they're quite serious, and we, as you know, and we want to make sure that we have the ability to do our work in investigative procedures. And at the same time, in these instances, if there are questions, and when in this one, when we talked, it was brought to my attention, prioritized, so we got to the bottom of it as soon as possible. And that's how I like to make sure things are happening. So.
Yeah, and thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Madam Chair, because what the department does, and I'm a big fan of the department, what the department does in investigating fraud and things such as that is exemplary. I mean, if you got a bad actor out there, I say put them in jail and throw the keys away. I mean, if they're ripping somebody off or harming anybody in any way in the financial area, that's just what I believe. But in the case where Minshew was bullying a helpless insurance agent, it really bothered me. And I'll talk to you about that offline. And also in this bill, thank you for not repealing anything 4C. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Atkins, I just want to commend you for having NAIC model legislation and smoothly getting that passed and into the bill on the first try. Thank you.
Any other questions? I don't see anybody. Representative Atkins.
And thank you, Madam Chair. We do have a couple of additional amendments, mm-hmm. and then I believe a technical amendment that the department has, and I wanted to, you know, we went through the author's amendment initially. Representative Falk has an amendment, and I have the A1, and then we've got the technical amendment. I believe that either Mr. Kwapik.
And actually, Representative Atkins, we do have Vic Morrow who wants to testify as well. Should we go to the amendment first and then bring Vic down?
On the technical amendment, Madam Chair, has that one been coded at this point?
Well, we could do the technical amendment.
And
let's do that.
All right. I would. I just soon have just to make sure it's correct. If either Mr. Kwapik has the language or if Mr. Fender has
the
language for the technical amendment that the. Let's just hold on that one. We'll hear from Mr. Morrow, then
right.
Representative Falks, but maybe give you guys a chance to get that language sorted out.
Mr. Moore. Where is it? We do have a question over here. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as we're doing that, I had a question, Representative Atkins, about Section 24, the protective restraining order authorized. Page 24. Thank you.
Perhaps as you're doing your question, Representative Woodard, we could invite the department folks to come back with respect to it. They know more if it's going to be any sort of technical question.
Well, Madam Chair and Chair Atkins, I was just curious as to what would entail, what would be required in order for a public employer to actually want to do a restraining order. I wasn't quite sure exactly what the incident might be that would trigger that, actually.
Well, Representative Atkins.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Woodard. I may be able to shortcut that a little bit. That's part of the technical amendment of the section that's coming out.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
And I think we're just trying to make sure that we've got the language correct with respect to the technical, but I appreciate the question.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Okay.
Do we have that technical amendment at this point, or are we still?
Are we still working on it? I think we're still working on it.
Okay. Why don't we go to Representative Falk's amendment,
Let's
and then
Representative Falk,
the
A2,
the A1 as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an amendment that had an issue where I think it was a person that had called about their policy and inquired if they were to file a claim, and ended up not doing so, but still saw their rate and their policy go up as a result of the inquiry. Basically just says that an insurance company cannot impose a surcharge because a person has asked either what the coverage is or whether or not it's would be more beneficial for them to go through and filing a claim or just to go in and fix some damage outright. And so this would just prohibit that changing of your rate. I talked to the chair about this, and I'm not sure if you'd like to speak to it, but it seemed like a reasonable place to put this.
Representative Atkins.
And Madam Chair, that's part of the reason I'm fine with the amendment. We had it posted a considerable time before the bill was heard. I've not heard any objection from anyone. I'm assuming that Representative Falk is not either.
I have not.
But unless there's anybody that has concerns.
Any members want to speak to the A2? Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Falk, I apologize if you just said this and I missed it, but did you go over the genesis? I mean, where this came from and why we're...
Thank you.
And if I missed it, just tell me I missed it. Sorry.
Yeah, it was basically, I had a person mention that they had inquired about potentially filing a claim. Didn't actually file the claim, but their rate was increased because they had made...
Representative Swedinski.
Thank you. And my question is to Representative Falk. Is this an issue of the insured going directly to the insurer rather than maybe going through their agent?
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Swedinski, to my understanding, the person spoke with their agent.
And then the agent did the refund?
Representative Swedinski. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, all I know is that the person had inquired about whether or not something should be covered or the cost would be, didn't file a claim actually, and had their rate go up.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to this amendment, I think we have a situation once in a while where you'll even file a claim, but it doesn't reach the deductible, so nothing happens. There's nothing paid, but yet they get a surcharge, I think. And so maybe Mr. Pender.
I can help this.
Mr. Pender, what are we doing here? I think the Falk Amendment is saying that if someone calls the company, like a township mutual or a regular mutual or stock company, that the companies can surcharge someone even though they never made a claim, and or the issue is if somebody files a claim but nothing's paid, they can have a surcharge. Can they do that now?
Matter of fact, we might actually. We've got
Representative Davis. I do think we called a friend up here, Bob Johnson.
Okay,
Bob.
Madam Chair, committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Yeah. Just really quickly, if you don't have to pull it, but if you looked in the blue books back behind there, this practice is already prohibited in 65A.29 and 72A.20. So Minnesota law currently prohibits non-renewals, the initial underwriting, or pricing based on a hypothetical claim. So an individual calling the company or their agent. So today in the law, this language that Representative Falk has, Senator Goodwin is advancing it. And on line 1.5, if I could suggest a friendly amendment, it would match Senator Goodwin's language. Then after insurance, if you put solely as a result of a consumer inquiry, then there was no opposition to it from the industry. And because we think it's already prohibited, and if this helps the comfort factor that it's prohibited, we don't have an objection to Representative Falk for what you're advancing.
Madam Chair.
Representative Davids.
Thank you. What about the issue, Mr. Johnson, of filing a claim and you got $1,000 deductible and after the claim it was $993, so the company didn't pay? Could you have a surcharge in that scenario?
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, I think, Madam Chair and Representative Davis, I mean, that's different than right now what Representative Falk's advancing. It's just a hypothetical. I think if you actually have a claim, then there was actual damage to the property, and you're filing notice of that claim, then they're just adjusting it in accordance with the terms of the policy. And as you know, Representative Davis, that homeowners insurers all have different surcharge plans, and so if you look at the surcharge plans, it may or may not have an impact on that consumer, depending on the company.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess they're two different issues. I support the Falk Amendment, and hopefully we can get that amended, but I can see another amendment coming to the Atkins bill later here, because I think that if a claim is filed and nothing's paid, that someone should not be surcharged. That's a different issue, so I would speak in favor of an amended Falk Amendment.
Representative Falk. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Davids, I'd be happy to work with you on subsequent amendment to that nature, but I would be more than willing to incorporate the technical change to this that was suggested if that could be repeated once more, just to make sure that everybody is on board and it's reflected accurately, I'd happily incorporate that.
And Madam Chair, I can speak to that. It would be on line 1.5 of the A2 amendment offered by Representative Falcon, would insert the word solely after the word insurance. So again, on line 1.5, insert the word solely after the word insurance. Is that being incorporated then by Representative?
Yes, I will incorporate that into the amendment.
Any other discussion to the A2 as amended? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Thank you, Representative Falk. That has been accepted. Representative Atkins, back to...
And thank you, Madam Chair. And next step is the A1 amendment. That's my amendment. Brought it on behalf of the optometrist. A bill that they had that was going to be before us last week sort of ran into some issues, but we wanted to make sure that the issue was heard by this committee. Mr. Harris has, I believe there's a testifier who will speak in favor or explain what the A1 amendment does, Madam Chair.
And who is the testifier? Representative Atkins, is he here?
I think he's coming
okay,
down
here
right
he comes.
Now.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Have a seat and introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. good afternoon. I'm Dr. Larry Morrison, currently president of the Minnesota Optometric Association, and I have an optometric practice in Detroit Lakes and Manoman. And I'd like to thank Representative Atkin for bringing this amendment, and also to Representative Schoen and for Representative Fritz for co-authoring this. there are a little over 900 licensed optometrists in the state of Minnesota. Most of them are small business owners. We have been included in the Affordable Care Act, and we're struggling to find our position to fit into it. And right now, what this bill brings forward is it's an amendment to prevent a managed care company from controlling prices and requiring discounts on non-covered services and products provided by optometrists. And that's the key, is the non-covered services. Optometrists routinely contract with HMOs and health insurance companies to provide certain covered services. That wouldn't change. Optometrists also provide optional non-covered services and products to patients. But HMOs and health insurance companies are routinely mandating as a contractual requirement that optometrists set certain fees and give automatic discounts on products and services that the insurance company does not cover. And that's not fair. Insurance companies use these unfair stipulations to improve their marketability of their plan to big business at the expense of the small business optometrist. So if they want to sell their vision plan to a big company, they have to be competitive with the other vision plans, and they're making the small business optometrists bear the brunt of it. An insurance company should not be able to fix the price of another business's service or product that they don't bear any financial responsibility in providing that coverage for. Insurance companies promoting its own product while shifting the cost and financial obligations onto the small business optometrist and away from itself. This bill only applies to non-covered services and products that are entirely optional services and products that a patient may choose to receive. The terms for covered benefits, services, and products are not affected. It should not cause any increase in fees. Examples of optional non-covered services and products would include second or third pair of glasses, upgraded lenses, lens options, and special lens coatings. They've also got into the realm of mandating or requiring optometrists to discount their office calls. Now, a normal optometrist office has two sides of it. They have the optical side, but we also provide for the eye health care of Minnesotans. So if somebody comes in with a red eye, they no longer have to go to the emergency room. They can come and see their optometrist. The optometrist takes care of them. We can prescribe eye drops and do the treatment plans for them. Now, the vision plans are saying that when they come in for your office calls, you have to discount those as well, which has nothing to do with the vision plan. So this bill extends to optometrists the same protections from insurance control that the legislator granted to the dentist a few years ago in Minnesota, which was in 2011. Now, the opposition to this bill came in at the ninth hour. It's a national organization. They're big. It's frustrating as optometrists that if we get together, in fact, we can't get together as a group because it's considered antitrust or collusion. So we have to face these big vision plans on our own. And it's a little bit disingenuous that the people that represented the dentists back in 2011 that passed this bill are actually now trying to keep us from doing the same thing. So similar bills have been passed in four other states for optometrists. They're pending in eight other states, and in most states, the dentists have passed this. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Morrison. Yes, we do have a couple of questions. Representative Dean. And then.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. So what the providers are requesting of optometrists, do you know if that's different than what they're requesting of the larger providers that are out, or not the, the larger stores and optical centers that are out there?
Mr. Morrison.
I can only speak for the independent optometrists. That's what I am, and I have not had a chance to ask any of the chain optometrists if that's affecting them or not. Those usually the chain optometrists work for big industries. You have Luxottica, you've got your Pearle Visions, Walmart Visions. Those are big entities as themselves. So I'm not so sure if they're affected by it or not. But it is definitely affecting the independent optometrists.
Representative Dean.
And just follow up, because I think it's important to understand if they're applying this equally to everybody or if they're treating these larger areas of business in a different way than they're treating the smaller areas of business. I think it's something critical to consider.
And we have Representative Swedinsky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good to see you, Dr. Morris. Kind of a question just general towards, I think you may have covered it with the last question, but to a lot of, quite a number of optometrists that are connected to hospitals, so Avera's and Sanford's and those, I mean, would you lump them together as, you know, kind of that in-between, or where would they stand? I don't know if anyone's from the Hospital Association here part of this, and what would they...
Well, if they sign up for the vision plans, they're probably going to have to give those same discounts. But if they work for a major hospital, they'd have to go through the hospital. And I'm just assuming that a major hospital would not agree to give those discounts on office calls or medical services.
Any follow-up, Representative? All right. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I'm missing something here, but can you tell me how this is consumer-friendly?
Mr. Morrison.
As far as consumer-friendly, I think America was built on the ability to run your own business. And I think that over the years, each business has had the ability to come up with their normal and customary fees. And it just is not right to have a company like a big insurance plan tell you what you have to charge. I mean, that should shake out just like competition. And as far as consumer friendly, it is it should not change over what it has been over the past number of years.
Representative
Slocum. This is something new they're starting to do.
Representative Slocum.
Again, I'm missing something because this doesn't seem to me to be very consumer friendly.
Mr. Morrison.
I'm talking consumers. I'm not talking a small business owner. I'm talking, here I am. I've been consuming for years. And I want the most effective, the lowest price for the nicest, the coolest glasses
right.
that I can get. And so, and you're saying this is, you know, small business, blah, blah, blah. It's a big world out there. How is this friendly to consumers? Because I don't see it.
Mr. Morrison.
Yeah, yeah. Another thing that's a definite possibility is if small business, again, we have certain costs that we have. We've got our building to pay for. If we're a good optometric office, we have a number of staff. So we have our certain overheads, things like that. And if all of a sudden we have to implement new discounts, then where are we going to make up the difference? So on the other hand, the people that aren't on those vision plans, we have to make up the difference somewhere. So there's a definite possibility that costs could go up for the consumer that aren't on the vision plans. I mean, there's a equation that's out there right now that's working quite well. But if all of a sudden we are forced to discount for this certain segment of the population and we have to maintain our ability to stay in business, it has to go somewhere.
Representative Slocum, follow up. Representative Anderson.
Yeah. Madam Chair, if there's other testifiers, I can wait until after that.
Representative Atkins.
And Madam Chair, thank you. I want to thank Dr. Morrison for joining us and presenting his testimony, and for members and their questions. I think there's a compelling argument that the optometrists make. I also understand that this idea has fostered considerable controversy among committee members who've been kind enough to share their thoughts with me, and I frankly can count votes. I know that today, as we sit here, there are not enough votes to pass this amendment onto this bill. So that being said, I anticipate withdrawing the amendment for today. I'd rather not have it voted down. But I do appreciate your patience in hearing the compelling argument that Dr. Morrison has made. You've also seen additional comments from others that are concerned about this bill. All I'd ask is that the proponents and opponents continue to have this discussion. Quite frankly, they should be hopefully working together, right? I mean, you've got folks that are providing a service and others who are paying the provider, and ideally all serving at the end of the day the consumer, the customer. So what I'd ask for at this time is that they continue to work on this, and hopefully we can figure something out. Otherwise, I anticipate we'll probably see amendments on the floor and we'll see amendments on other bills, and so I'd invite both sides to continue working on the discussion or having the discussion and ideally working something out. And with that, Madam Chair, and again, thank you, Dr. Morrison. I will withdraw my A1 amendment.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Representative Atkins withdraws the A1 amendment. We do have another testifier, Vic Moore.
No. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Moore is unable to be with us today. My name is Bill Griffin.
Okay.
And I appreciate the opportunity to be here. It's been a long week for a number of us.
Well, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I just want to speak very briefly on behalf of America's Health Insurance Plans, the National Trade Association representing the health insurance industry. AHIP's members provide health supplemental benefits to more than 200 million Americans through employee-sponsored coverage. And I want to just address very quickly Articles 5 and 6 of this bill. And my understanding is, Madam Chair and members, that there are two more amendments coming before you today. We've been working very hard with the Commerce Department to try and reach agreement on these. But the two articles that the Commissioner already referred to that are NAIC model acts for ORSA and for holding company are very important for passage this year so that we as companies that are domiciled here in Minnesota, I also represent Preferred One, which is one of those companies, are able to file here and have those filings accepted in other states. It's a very simple concept, and this committee sees these kinds of things all the time, but these are two bills that have been working their way through the system. So we would just ask for your support and quick passage of these. They have to be adopted by 2015 or we will be out of compliance, and that would make life miserable not only for your regulators here but for those that are regulated and your customers. Madam Chair, those are my quick comments. We have not seen the amendments yet, and I understand they're coming to us very quickly. We'd like to have a chance to look at them. but I'm going to ask the author's indulgence that if they aren't exactly what we negotiated with the department between now and the floor, we have an opportunity to work with him to make sure we dot all the I's, cross all the T's, and work through those things. Because as the staff pointed out, it's been a long week.
Well, thank you, Mr. Griffin. We appreciate your testimony and taking the time to come down.
Mr. Morgan. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll say hi to Mr. Moore when I see him.
Would you do that? Thank you. Members, any questions? Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe I missed it, Chair Atkins. I didn't see that the technical amendment addressed Section 24.
Madam Chair and Representative Woodard, what I'd like to do in light of the fact that they're literally still hot off the copier, is to invite the department to come down and do a little brief walkthrough of the A8 and A9 amendments before we adopt them, and specifically address Section 24 concerns that you raised earlier.
All right, thank you.
So with that, Madam Chair, if I might, I'll move the A8 amendment and invite the department have their representative walk through the A8. We'll do that one, and then we'll do the same with respect to the A9.
Madam Chair, Peter Brickwitty from the Commerce Department. Members, I can step through the A8 very quickly. Sections 1 through 5 are all additional language related to the appraiser licensing conformity provisions that are already in the bill. You know, the federal government has made changes to federal licensing for appraisers, and all states are doing conformity. We had a large number of provisions in last year's department technical bill, and these items were left out of the draft, so we're adding them back in. Then on page 4, the page and line amendments, section 6 is changing an effective date for a bill that was passed last session, pushing that out for the department to continue to work with industry to implement that effectively. The page and line amendments, I can step through them, but specifically the page 24, section 24 amendment on line 4.8 is removing the border protection language that was a question earlier.
We have questions from some members. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Brickwitty, I'm asking this because Representative Davids is not here, and he will chastise me if I don't ask this. Does this increase the continuing education level?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative Hoppe, I'm sorry, Representative Davids is not here for my one-word answer, no.
Thank you.
Any other questions, members, on this amendment? Seeing none. Representative Atkins, we will move the A8 amendment. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The A8 amendment is adopted.
And, Madam Chair, with that, I will move the A9 amendment, and we've got representation from the department again. And I will assure, as Mr. Griffin asked, that if there is anything reflected in either of the two amendments that got to us relatively late but still in time for members to view them, that is not reflective of the agreement between the department and the stakeholders, we'd certainly be willing to sit down with the department and the stakeholders again to make sure that we've got every T crossed and every I dotted and all the punctuation in the place. So with that, I'll move the A9 amendment and would invite Mr. Brickwitty to do a brief walkthrough of that as well.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, thank you. The A9 amendment reflects agreement that we have been working with the insurers. And I'd like to thank Catherine Commit and Phil Griffin and Robin Rowan and Bob Johnson and several of their colleagues who have been working with us on this. This language will replace the language beginning at the beginning of Article 4 related to the department's orders, powers, and Representative Davids was asking some questions there. This will allow the department to issue an order that would become final in the event that a licensee does not respond and ask for a hearing after 30 days. We expect that to be a great savings of time and energy, both for the department, the Office of Administrative Hearings, and for the Attorney General's Office.
Very good. Any questions, members, on this amendment? Seeing none, the A9 amendment, all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The A9 amendment is adopted. Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, that concludes the bill and multiple amendments, and I appreciate your patience. I did and would be remiss if I didn't note, and they didn't ask me to do this, but from Commissioner Rothman on down, This was a monumental lift, not just this bill, but the unsession bill. Literally hundreds of pages, actually I think thousands of pages were reviewed in the course of the unsession review. And then this housekeeping element, they could have just rolled through everybody. They literally invited everybody in and have been embracing the suggestions and recommendations, not just for unsession, but for the housekeeping bill. And I genuinely appreciate, and I know anybody that's ever chaired or been a part of this committee, certainly appreciates the enormous lift that is involved in doing so. So I'd like to thank them. With that, Madam Chair, as amended, I would renew my motion that House File 2853 be referred to the General Register.
Representative Atkins moves the House File 2853 as amended be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. The bill is on its way. Thank you for an awesome job, Representative
thank
Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members into the department, all those who testified.
Very good. Very good. Work. That must have been 90% of it. Thank you.
That was easy.
We still want people to think we do. And Representative Radinovich, thank you so much for your willingness. I know you've got folks here who've traveled some distance as well. The chair will move Representative Radinovich's House File 3183 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Radinovich, it's my understanding that you do have a DE1 author's amendment. Is that correct?
It's just an A1 author's
amendment. A1 author's amendment. Let me just make sure that I've got the coding right.
Do I have the wrong letter?
Well, I've got a DE1 and then I've got an A1. We made some additional. The problem is, Representative, there were just some additional tweaks.
Okay.
So it was simpler to put it in a DE1 okay. than an A1. So the chair will move the author's amendment, the DE1 amendment, to put it in the shape that the author would like to proceed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
That motion prevails. Representative Radinovich, your bill is amended.
Thank you, Chair Atkins, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here in front of the Commerce Committee today. What we have before us here is a bill related to tourism on Lake Mille Lacs. And so what we're asking is that because Lake Mille Lacs is facing a unique situation where we've got some challenges in front of us, but, you know, as often is the case with challenges, it presents a unique opportunity to move forward in a new way. And in order to do that, we need some resources so that we can market the lake to Minnesotans and those across the region that would avail themselves of the amenities in the area. We feel that this is an urgent matter and that it's an appropriate use of the Explore Minnesota tourism dollars that are allocated in the bill here. And I've got with me today Tina Chapman, who's with the Mille Lacs Tourism Council, and she can kind of explain some of the situation right now and then also maybe speak to the plan that's in place a little bit with some deliverables that will promote the lake across the state and the region.
And welcome.
Good afternoon, Chairman Atkins and committee members. My name is Tina Chapman, and I'm the Executive Director of Mille Lacs Area Tourism Council, and I'd like to thank you for allowing me to testify today in support of House File 3183. Mille Lacs Area Tourism Council is a marketing co-op and is primarily funded through lodging taxes. This last year, two of our larger contributors have closed their businesses, thus cutting our marketing dollars. Many of our lodging members anticipate or have already experienced a drop in business, which also means a drop in marketing funds. We are trying to prepare for an anticipated 20% drop in 2014. Fishing on Lake Mille Lacs has been a way of life for generations of Minnesotans. The Lake Mille Lacs area and its businesses will be facing some very difficult years ahead due to the changing ecological conditions and the low walleye safe harvest quota. The DNR is tightening walleye fishing regulations because of the distressed health of the lake caused by numerous factors, including clear water and invasive species. The area and its businesses are feeling the negative impact now. And it's not just the resorts. The effects go far deeper, right down to our schools losing students because families are moving away to find jobs. We are working with Explore Minnesota Tourism and have already hired a marketing company to assist us with developing a new identity strategy through online website enhancements, social media, and traditional media relations. We hope these efforts will help offset the negative impacts the lake is facing. It's critical that we receive additional funding to drive further development of these marketing programs, and we are diligently working to enhance the perception of Lake Mille Lacs as being much more than a fishing destination. For example, do you know Mille Lacs was known as a premier kiteboarding destination? We know it will take time and money to change people's perception of Mille Lacs, but all of us agree that this is a first step to ensure the region can prosper in the future. In closing, the Lake Mille Lacs area needs your help to bridge the unique and immediate hardships we are facing.
Thank you very much. Representative Radinovich, is there anyone else that you have set to testify?
Due to the short notice here and the expedient nature with which we must handle the situation, we've just got Ms. Chapman here.
Very good. And I do want to acknowledge also Representative Erickson, who's raised concerns about this same issue, as well as Representative Purcell and Ward McNamara.
And Representative Erdahl as well.
And Representative Erdahl, who are on the bill. And so it's one of those where partisanship goes out the way. When you're talking about Mille Lacs, it's a Minnesota issue.
And Mr. Chair, in the Senate, we have a bipartisan team of authors as well. And, we're all paying close attention to the situation. We want to work together and as quickly as possible to address the situation.
Thank you. And we do have Representative Anderson. Did you have a question or concern?
I do, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, Representative Radinovich, have you had a conversation with the Explore Minnesota Tourism? We have an actual legislative board that oversees things. What is their comment? Do they have feedback? Are they in support? Are they opposed? What do the rest of the board members think on using these dollars this way?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I have personally had conversations with two members or representatives of Explore Minnesota, including John Edmond, and while they have I think some reservations about taking too much money that had been otherwise they have some concerns about, I think, allocating too much of the money. It was my indication as of yesterday that they were willing to work with us on the Mille Lacs provision for $100,000.
Representative Anderson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Radinovich. They have it within their power and control to do these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I guess I'd like to get greater feedback from them to see what their thought process is on this, how they do divvying up of the dollars overall, too. I think that would be helpful for the rest of the state. It's kind of unusual for us to do this legislatively when they have that power to do it that way. So it'd be great if you could get some kind of letter from them stating, what their thoughts are on this piece. I think that would be helpful.
And Representative Anderson, I kind of violated my own rule. I usually take all the testimony and then we ask questions. We actually do have a testifier from Explore Minnesota. Isn't that something? How remarkable that works. So if we could hear that testimony as well, and then we'll open it up and see if we have other questions. Welcome back.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Colleen Tollefson with Explore Minnesota Tourism, and we definitely share the concern with Lake Mille Lacs, and we've been very, very involved with Lake Mille Lacs. We conducted a business survey on Mille Lacs this past fall that definitely verified that the business is down in a significant way and probably will continue to be down relative to the fishing situation. We've been working with the Tourism Council to diversify their marketing. That's our major focus with them. In October, we provided them with an $8,000 matching grant, which was part of our ongoing partnership program that we do with all communities around the state. And that's the maximum grant that you would be able to access through our existing partnership program. Then, based on the survey and the results that we got from the survey, in December, we provided them with a $35,000 additional matching grant so that they could hire a firm to start working on diversifying their marketing. We also have tried to incorporate Mille Lacs a lot more into our overall marketing so that when we do special promotions like this past winter, we did one called Checkpoint Minnesota that focused on 10 areas around the state, and we made sure that Mille Lacs was one of those 10 areas. So we're trying to do things throughout our entire marketing to put put more of an emphasis on Mille Lacs. In addition, we've been working with DNR, DEED, the Mille Lacs Band, the Initiative Fund, and others to try to identify other financial resources for the area so that it's not just state funding dependent, but that we're looking at every option for resources. We know there's going to be an ongoing need for funding with Mille Lacs, and I think that our concern would be that in providing funding, we have what we think is a process for special needs through a special grant program, and we would like to see it going through the process. I don't know that we would have the resources even within that process to provide up to $100,000, but we do try to address those needs and those if there were other communities as well through that special grant program. So our only concern in this really is the precedent and then the use of resources that we all already would be using for other purposes.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, anything further?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it was interesting, this actually on the drive-in this morning, I was listening to an NPR program and it was talking about how DNR had changed the hours. Now, nighttime fishing, they put it down to 10 o'clock rather than midnight, and that's creating quite a hardship for our resort owners out there, and I imagine several of the people on Mille Lacs. So hopefully you've had conversations with the DNR and what that means for those businesses, and good luck to you on that piece. So.
Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just along those lines.
Representative Radinovich.
Thank you, and I do appreciate that. Certainly the night fishing regulations that were released yesterday are, in my opinion, problematic, and I have been reaching out to the DNR, and as they were just announced yesterday, I haven't had an opportunity to specifically discuss the night regulations. But in addition to changing that regulation, they increased the northern allocation by 7 from 3 to 10, and also increased the small bass allocation and the slot limits or the slots around the small bass. And so, you know, we are all very interested in the fishery in Mille Lacs, but we also have to understand that we're going to go through some difficult times in the next couple of years and look beyond that, and that's why I think these resources are particularly important. So thank you.
We've got a couple other questions. Representative Woodard is up next, and then Swidzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Radinovich, is the intention to have the each dollar of state incentive matched by $6 of private sector funding as the rest of the program is?
Representative Radinovich?
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, no, it's not. My understanding is that that's a total allocation for Explore Minnesota, and then those resources are then allocated outside of that. So we pulled the chapter here to amend that.
Representative Woodard?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question can either go to the folks from Explore Minnesota Tourism, but I think generally, you know, looking at a budgetary standpoint, I think it was John, Representative Ward, that carried this bill and talked about how we need to be focusing our dollars outside of the state because we're getting intense pressure from, I believe, the Wisconsin Dells. They spend more money than we do just for one portion of Wisconsin. I'm guessing before this bill was laid before us, you had these dollars budgeted. And I wanted to see, you know, from your standpoint, where do you feel that one portion of your potential budget would be affected, and where do you think those dollars are going to come from?
Ms. Dowson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, our budget is allocated. This, I believe, is for the next fiscal year in terms of where the money would come from. So it would just be a reduction in our overall marketing. We do marketing both within the state and outside of the state, and hopefully we can address some of the Mille Lacs needs without necessarily a special appropriation. But it would be our overall marketing.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Radinovich.
And to Representative Swidzinski's question, sorry, Representative Swidzinski, you have as difficult a name as I do, and often, I'm sure. But and I'm certainly interested in working with Explore Minnesota. Representative Ward is a co-author on this bill as well. And, you know, for those of us up in Lake Country, I mean, tourism is a way of life, and it's very important to not just the state, but the region and the individual jobs and lives of the people who work there. And so, you know, I'd be happy to work with Representative Ward, any other representatives in this body, to increase or find a way to make sure that we put our best foot forward when marketing Minnesota and Minnesota lakes and amenities.
Thank you, Representative Radinovich, and thank you, Representative Erickson, for joining us as well. We're all concerned about the same issue. With that, the chair will renew his motion that House File 3183 as amended be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Representative Johnson will move House File 2767 be re-referred to the General Register. And Representative Johnson, it's my understanding that the A14-0997 amendment is an author's amendment, so Representative Johnson will move that amendment. All in favor of the author's amendment say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Johnson, to your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. When the bill was first heard in Labor, Workplace, and Regulated Industries, it was a rather small bill, and we asked that the interested parties in the world of telecom come up with some more things that could be taken out of current statute that are no longer relevant, and they did that. Hence, that's the amendment that was just put into play. I can go briefly through some of the major points, but just kind of as a summary statement, the first telecom bill was passed in 1915, and a lot of these statutes stem from that and from issues that, again, are no longer pertinent to the world of telecom. The bill that you have before us does have the full agreement of the PUC, Department of Commerce, the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, consumer advocates, the CLEC for the competitive local exchange carriers, and other telecom interests. So it is a consensus bill, and it's non-controversial. The repealers that are noted, there's no tricks or anything sneaky there. They're all straightforward. So unless members have questions, it is what it is.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Are there questions or concerns for members or anyone else who desires to be heard with respect to House File 2767? Members, you'll note and remember that not more than 45 minutes ago, we took the provisions and placed these in the overall Commerce Department bill. But nonetheless, just in case we run into issues, we're moving along 2767 independently as well in terms of full disclosure. Unless there's any questions, Representative Johnson then will renew his motion to House File 2767 as amended. Be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Fortman is our final bill of the afternoon. She'll move that House File 2603 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. It's my understanding, Representative Fortman, that the A1 amendment is your amendment. It's an author's amendment. Put the bill in shape that the author desires to move forward with it. All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Fortman, your bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd also like to move an oral amendment and delete lines 2.4 and 2.5.
For a moment there, I thought you were going to move a moral amendment.
Perhaps
it's a moral amendment as well. Representative Hortman moves for oral amendment, deleting lines 2.4 and 2.5. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Hortman, your bill is amended twice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Earlier this year, we passed a $20 million appropriation for energy assistance. We said that if there was any excess, that it would revert to the general fund. What House File 2603 would allow the Department of Commerce to use any excess for weatherization programs to hopefully try to reduce the need for more energy assistance next year. The other thing is, you might recall, the House worked very expeditiously and we passed our bill on the first day of session. The Senate took a little bit more time, and then they added a provision to reduce the amount that the community action programs could keep for administrative expenses. They maybe made a mistake there. They cut them down to 5% for administrative expenses, and that was really more than what the caps could really handle. So they've asked us to try to remedy the situation, and I believe the Senate's in agreement that there was a mistake and we need to fix that. So we've changed the percent administrative expenses they can recover from 5 to 8 to kind of fix something. I think this in the House we would say the Senate screwed up. The other part of the bill is a Metsä-Tomasoni provision that takes revenue bond authority that the Department of Commerce currently has, and it better defines what they can use it for, and it expands it. Right now, the revenue bond authority that the Department of Commerce has is only for micro-energy projects. Micro-energy projects being sort of a mystery category, none of the revenue bond authority was used. There is, however, a need for large industrial energy users to have
financing assistance available to undertake energy efficiency projects. And so what this would do is it would allow public-private partnerships like what the St. Paul Port Authority has done, and with their authority they've created 900 jobs, by loaning money to the entities that would do the energy efficiency projects, and then the money would be repaid. So it doesn't require any appropriation. I talked to Bill Marks to make sure that when we pass a bill like this that there is no fiscal impact, and he assured me that there is none. I also talked to Deb Dyson, who does all the bonding work for House Research, and she indicated that revenue bonds do not affect the state's overall indebtedness, so it doesn't need to travel to capital investment, and I did talk to Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Representative Fortman, for the exhaustive work that you did on that. Are there other anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to this legislation? Questions? Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hortman, just real quickly, when you struck lines 2.4, 2.5, can you run us through why we're getting rid of those two?
Representative Hortman?
Mr. Chair, I would like to phone a friend, Mr. Savory's here. Savory. And he can explain why we did that.
He can be very helpful on these sorts of questions. Mr. Savory.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The two lines that we struck, 2.4 and 2.5, brings this proposed statute into compliance with the budget rules that were passed, I believe, in 2013.
And we like to do that. Representative Hoppe, any other questions? Anyone else with questions or concerns? Not. Representative Hortman, then, will renew her motion that House File 2603 as amended be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hortman. That concludes our meeting for today. As I discussed with Representative Hoppe, in terms of there is a couple of topics that we may take up after session for purposes of hearing those bills, primary among those being Internet gaming and the extent to which the Minnesota State Lottery engages in Internet gaming. There's a handful of bills which we, which we may take up. I'll be in touch with Representative Hoppe. We obviously will try to accommodate people's schedules as best we can. With that, folks, we stand adjourned. Have a wonderful evening. Anybody hear anything?